Welcome to Best Movies Never Made, the podcast where we explore interesting and infamous movies that never made it to or through production. I am your co-host, Josh Miller, and with me, as always, is Mr. Steven Scarlatta.
How you doing today, Josh?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm hyped.
Yeah, we are excited because joining us today is Mr. Alex Winter. He is an actor and a director. As an actor, I'm sure you've maybe seen a little franchise in which he plays Bill S. Preston Esquire, the Bill and Ted Excellent Adventure trilogy. Yeah, it's a trilogy officially. As a director, Steve and I are big fans of his movie Freaked. My wife and I also loved his documentary Zappa. He's a guy who's been kicking around, I feel, directing way more things than you even know about. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Yes, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And we are able to nab you in part because you are promoting a new movie that you starred in called Destroy All Neighbors, that was also starring and produced by friend of our podcast, Jonah Ray. If you're longtime listeners, you might remember him from our Jurassic Park 4 episode.
Yeah, Jonah's great. That was how I got onto this cockeyed caravan in the first place.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to get to see it on the big screen in a packed audience at the Arrow in Santa Monica, and it played great. I mean, it definitely, you guys talked about it in the Q&A, but, you know, it felt like, I don't want to say return to form, because that implies that you went away, but, you know, for fans of Freaked, I feel they will also like Destroy All Neighbors, because it's you really hamming it up, turned up to 11 in the movie. I think the way people like to see you.
Yeah, I mean, I like acting in prosthetics and certain types of things. I got to do it again in Bill and Ted 3 just a few years ago with a couple of the same people who worked on this on the prosthetic side. You know, I come from a theater background, so it's a type of acting that I enjoy, but only under certain circumstances and when you get to really go all the way. And in the service of comedy, it's really more my thing. I'm not really likely to be the next Freddy Krueger. But so this was a fun opportunity to do that in a splatter comedy with the emphasis on comedy.
And do you like the fact that you're kind of hidden behind it? Or do you like the way it makes you physically kind of stretch yourself to trend, you know?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's very much the latter. You're not really hiding, right? Because you're still you, and the makeup is so light that you don't feel it. So it doesn't feel like you have like a hood on or a mask on. Like you're going out when you go out for Halloween, you got a big thick rubber mask, and you really feel like you're hiding. In prosthetics, you don't. You really feel like yourself, but you sort of transform into the character and through the character that you're playing, which is kind of what acting is anyway. Despite all this talk about, you know, refusing to be called by anything other than your character on set and other nonsense, you know, acting is really about being yourself through whatever the character is. So this is just, like you said, this is that turned up to 11. It's very liberating.
It cracks me up every time, like, I was a fan of Squeal of Death and Idiot Box. Whenever you're in some type of prosthetic, you play this like unhinged, out of control character. Dude, I'm always dying. And the moment you're in this movie, pushing the couch and grunting.
Yeah, very unhinged. So I should say Destroy All funny. Neighbors is available on Shudder.
Thank you.
Is it also available on like iTunes? Or is it just
I think you
Shudder?
Can get to Shudder through Amazon and other things. I mean, there's a window, obviously. It's a release window. So, but Shudder was our home. They financed the movie and made it, and they've been amazing partners. But we will eventually be out on all of those other streamers, as well as on DVD, Blu-ray, and all that. That's all.
Oh, great. Yeah, the movie's Jonah Ray plays, you know, a mild-mannered prog rock musician wannabe who's just trying to finish his album and lives in a apartment building full of kooky neighbors, and then the kookiest one yet moves in, played an unrecognizable Alex Winter in full body prosthetics. I love the accent you do in that, but but we know we only have you for a little bit of time here, so we want to get into your unmade movies. And I guess even just starting up, like, was there anything before Freaked? I know you made a lot of short films, including one with the Butthole Surfers and a very young pre-fame John Hawks called Barbecue Movie. But before Freaked got off the ground, you know, kind of as your acting star was rising, I'm sure you were trying to utilize that to get movies off the ground.
Yeah, I mean, funny, I'm sure you deal with this all the time, just given that what your podcast is about. But if you're going to write, you better have unmade movies, right? Or you are not good at what you do. If like you wrote a movie, you made it. You wrote another one, you made it. I don't know. Like for me, I'm proud of the unmade movies because they were fertilizer towards the movies that got made. And so I've got drawers filled with unmade movies. But some of those you work more hard than others on actually getting into production. Some you go, well, I really needed to write this, but I'm not going to try to make this. I mean, I wrote a movie a couple of years ago that I don't want to make right now, but I needed to write it. And it was an important, I mean, you know this from writing, right? It was important in the next step to what I was going to do after that. And so when Tom Stern and I, you alluded to him a minute ago, we came out of NYU Film School together. We made Squeal of Death at NYU. It caught the eye of Sam Raimi. I started acting. I got Lost Boys. I dropped out of NYU. I moved to LA. Tom followed me out to LA. And we started writing movies all the time. We wrote a feature version of Squeal of Death that we tried to get made. We wrote a movie at Universal once I was starting Bill and Ted, and we wrote we sold a movie over there that was kind of like a biker movie about a Richie Rich who falls off a cruise ship and ends up with a biker gang trying to get home. It was a really funny script, actually. I was going to play the lead.
What was that called?
It was called Milo Rigby on Wheels. We wrote an anthology comedy for Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert that they tried desperately to get off the ground, and no one in town wanted it. That was called Laugh Out, just an abysmal title.
What year was that? Or roughly?
That would have been 19. Well, that's got a funny story because that would have been 1990, and then I got Bill and Ted, and Sam couldn't get it off the ground, and they tried and tried. And I went in, MTV asked me to come in for a meeting, and I went in and they pitched me doing the entire afternoon VJ slot as Bill. And I said, I'd rather jump headfirst out the window of this building than do that. But I do have a script for a show. And I basically just vamped and told them that Laugh Out script was actually a series.
And that became Idiot Box?
That became the Idiot Box.
Oh,
so
wow.
Basically, Tom and I, like, I went home. They said yes to that. I went home and Tom and I like furiously spent the night breaking that script up into parts. And then we sent it to them and they greenlit that. That became Idiot Box. Meantime, we went off and wrote a movie with Gibby Haynes from the Butthole Surfers called Freaks. That became Freaked, but was nothing like Freaked. It was a $200,000 gonzo horror movie starring the Buttholes. That was what the barbecue movie was kind of a prototype for. Family goes on a cross country trip, ends up at this roadside carnival. They all get turned into freaks, but it was like, there was a human bong. It was all like drugs and sex and rock and roll. And Sam and Rob tried again with that. Nobody had any interest. And by then I got Bill and Ted too. And I basically did the same thing. We basically were like, okay, screw it. And we pitched it to 20th Century Fox as a PG-13 comedy, and they said yes. And then the same thing happened. Tom and I were like, oh, shit, now we got to figure out how to actually turn this gonzo, this super low-budget gonzo horror movie, into like a fairly big-budget mainstream studio movie. And we kind of panicked. So we didn't really know what to do. We pulled in Tim Burns, who was our co-writer in Idiot Box, and the three of us hatched what became the movie Freaked.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I found a concept called IHOP. Was that before Freaked?
Okay, so this is what happened. So what IHOP was only lived between about as a movie. It was hatched as an idea at around 2 a.m. and it was dead by about 7 that morning. But we had worked the whole movie out in the 5 hours. And what happened was we had a meeting with Joe Roth the next day to walk them through what Freaked was going to be, because they said they were interested in it. It's a very big meeting for us, two 25-year-old guys. We'd never shot 35mm. We'd never gotten a feature off the ground yet. Idiot Box was a hit, so we had a teeny-weeny little bit of cachet, and Bill and Ted was a big hit, so I had cachet as an actor. But this was like going to meet the Wizard of Oz. We were shitting ourselves. So we were trying to figure out how to turn this low-budget horror movie into this mainstream movie. And by like 2 a.m, we just lost confidence in our ability to do it. We were like, you know what? we have this meeting with this huge studio exec. Why don't we just pitch him something else? Why don't we just figure out another movie? By then we were working with John Hawks and we loved John. And we were like, why don't we pitch him a movie starring John Hawks? As like, I play this, you know, dad who's like, you know, driving cross country with his family, kind of like the barbecue movie. I stop at a roadside IHOP in some middle of nowhere that's managed by John Hawks. And it turns out in kind of Lovecraftian fashion, there's this underground sort of cosmic evil universe under the IHOP that is sort of run cult style by John Hawks. And I'm not even sure John knows this. Like, I'm not sure I even ever told him we had spent an entire night mapping out another movie. And by 4 a.m, we thought it was the greatest idea we ever had. By 7, we realized it made no sense and we had to pitch Roth the movie that he thought he was getting. And we bashed it together and went in and had the pitch meeting. So that was the IHOP movie.
And yeah. Then and one more from that era before we move on was Geysers of Blood. Was that era also?
God, no, that sounds familiar. And I can't even remember. Stern may remember. I don't even remember what that is. But I do remember we had something called Geysers of Blood might have been the name of the Squeal of Death movie, actually. That's actually, I think, what that was. I think Geysers of Blood was the Squeal of Death movie, was the Howie movie. No, that was called Howie's Revenge. So no, I don't know what Geysers of Blood is.
This one, you wanted to remake D.W. Griffith's Intolerance as a Freddy Krueger type slasher movie?
I saw that this sounds like me. That sounds like me just making a joke in an interview I was bored doing.
That was Cinefantastique when you were promoting Bill and Ted at the time.
Oh yeah, I was probably not sober and not particularly interested in the interview, which was pretty much every interview I gave from like age 17 to 27.
What I love though is that seemed plausible to us reading this. They're just like, I think that's what we, I remember my friends and I were always so excited about, like Freaked and Idiot Boxes, you know, won't name any names, but so often when actors end up directing things, they're, you know, like serious dramas that mostly seem designed for the actors to be in it, to be winning awards. So we always love the fact that the movies you wanted to make were like so much more deranged than Bill. Like Bill and Ted seemed extremely normal compared to your, you know, own personal output.
Completely. I mean, at least Bogus Journey got some weirdness into it. And I love the Bill and Ted movies, so it's not to disparage them. But
no.
But I was always going in and basically bait and switching whoever I was talking to with whatever it was so that I could go do something more gonzo. And that was fun about Destroy. It was like when Jonah brought that to me, there was no, it was kind of oddly circular because I just come off Bill and Ted 3. And I thought, sure, why not? Why not use like what little cachet I have again as an actor to make another gonzo movie? Like nothing's changed. It's like a middle-aged, and I have not matured at all. It was precisely the same position that we found ourselves in yet again.
Was it weird to you at the time that you were, I mean, you always were acting in your movies, so it wasn't like you were just trying to be a director, but it must have been a little bit weird for your acting career to suddenly be like taking off in a real way. I mean, clearly you were able to utilize that to pull your directing career along with it.
Yeah, I mean, it was intentional. So, you know, I'd been a child actor. I'd acted on Broadway for a lot of my childhood and then went to film school to learn writing and directing. I went to NYU and I came out of NYU to do Lost Boys. But by then, I was directing all the time. I was at Propaganda and we were making music videos and short films, eventually The Idiot Box and everything. So through that whole period, I was directing constantly. And, you know, by Freaked, I really just wanted to focus on writing. I'd been acting for so long since I was so little, I kind of needed a break anyway, which is kind of common for child actors. And so it felt like a good time to sort of step away and just focus. That it had enough momentum that I could keep working with my filmmaking. And but I didn't, you know, ever lose the love of acting. It's just I'm kind of particular about what I act in. I don't want to, you know, I've got kids and I don't want to like go to like some far flung place and do 20 episodes of some series I would never watch being bored out of my mind and not being able to see my children. I'd rather make my docs and do the work that matters to me. And if I can find something interesting to act in, then I'll do it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, we know that Freaked maybe disappointed financially when it came out, but I was at the Egyptian screening from a few years ago, you know, and that was, they remodeled it so it has less seats now, but you know, it was like 700 seats completely sold out for Freaked. Unless, you know, it's, if you build it, they will come, right? I mean, it's got to be gratifying to know that the movie connected with so many people.
Yeah, it was. I mean, to be fair, we didn't come out and bomb. We just weren't released. We made the film for Joe Roth, and then he was replaced by an administration that didn't like or understand the movie, and they just killed it. And it was very straightforward. But even back then, we went to the Toronto Film Festival with the film in 92, and it was huge there. We got great reviews. We sold out.
Did it play midnight at Toronto?
We played midnight, exactly. Played Midnight Madness. And we immediately began to build a cult following. And then, to be fair to Fox, they began to support it. It was too late for them to give it a proper release, but they put it into heavy cable rotation on HBO and then on DVD and VHS. We did very well. So, I mean, yes, it was one of those kind of devastating studio experiences that you have, honestly, all the time if you're in the business. But it wasn't, like, by the time we got to the Egyptian, we'd had, which was 25 years later, we'd had a really good run. I mean, I get people stop me and talk to me about that movie all the time. So I didn't really feel like it just vanished. It just ended up being the cult movie that we had initially intended to make back with the original iteration, which was in a way kind of made sense. Like, you know, I all due respect to Joe Roth, like, it was a crazy thing for them to allow us to make. I mean, it was a $12 million in 92. So it's like a $30 million movie today, you know, movie that was basically a Basil Wolverton cartoon come to life. I mean, it's bananas. It makes no sense in the studio sort of world.
We were hyped for it in film school. We all had the film threat with you on the cover. I went opening day to the Lemley Sunset 5 to see it.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I remember when that was there.
Like, we were so psyched for that movie, like, I can't even tell you. So
yeah, I mean, Fox allowed us to put it into, like, basically into art house cinemas, right? That's what we did. We asked them for a print. They kind of gave us a print and a poster, and we would travel around putting it into art house theaters, and then we went to Europe and did the same thing there. So I don't know, I've always felt like it's had a lot of love. I don't really feel like it was underappreciated. It just got caught up in a crummy political situation. Yeah.
So, it was late 90s, so fandom was already getting onto the internet. I just know from so many people you screen, you know, their cult movies, and it's happy ending to the story, but it's often where, like, for 30 years, they didn't even know anyone liked the movie, you know?
Yeah,
exactly. So you didn't have to live through that, so that's good.
No, that would have really sucked, yeah.
I always thought it should have been nominated for Best Special Effects. And I know that sounds weird, but the amount of effects and how amazing everyone looked in that movie and the effects artists you had working on that movie, it's ridiculous.
Oh, there's no doubt that the makeup effects team should have been nominated. It's just, like, Oscars are just nonsense. I mean, I think, I don't remember what won that year, but it's crazy. I mean, it was the big, and that's no credit to me and Tom. I mean, that was, we had, you know, all of the best makeup effects artists in town were working on it. It was all practical effects. And there was a lot of revolutionary work done on that movie that then got used in other movies down the road. Again, no credit to us. That was, like, Bill Corso and Screaming Matt George and Tony Gardner and, like, Steve Johnson, the best of the best of the best, did that movie and did incredible work.
And just for fact checking, Mrs. Doubtfire won Best Makeup.
Oh my
that
God,
year.
Good Lord.
Yeah, that's just one effect versus
one very know? Mild
it's
makeup
just the
job.
Same old shit you've seen for, I mean, it's like, yeah, it's like Tootsie basically. But all right, fair enough.
But before we started recording, you mentioned a movie that we had not found in our research that was going to be right after Freaked.
Yeah. So after Freaked, Tom and I had been working together for almost a decade by then. And we went our separate ways, and I started working on the next film I wanted to do. And I wrote, like, three other movies that I didn't think were going to, I wrote a big sci-fi movie that was, like, sort of an art house sort of level sci-fi. And then a friend of mine and I wrote this movie called Weed, my friend Andy Hawkins from the band Blind Idiot God, who did a lot of the stuff in Freaked. And Andy and I grew up in St. Louis in St. Louis and around the Ozarks. And we knew that culture really well. We wrote a movie about a family of pot farmers, basically like Tobacco Road, basically a modern day moonshining movie about a family of an agrarian family in the hills of Tennessee that have been there for 300 years. And then eventually as farming went under, they became moonshiners. And when moonshining went under, they became pot farmers. So it was really like this big kind of epic story of this family. And we cast Kevin Bacon and Kira Sedgwick were going to play the leads, their husband and wife. LaVon Helm was their dad. We had this just absolutely incredible cast. And it was this big epic that ends with a standoff with the feds and they all get killed. And it's extremely violent and the sort of epic. And they have like this underground cave filled with arms. And it was somewhat referencing Ruby Ridge and a lot of things that were going on in the country at the time. And I was in pre-production and we were going. And it was a fairly big movie, and my production design was on, and my DP was on, and then Columbine happened.
Oh,
and I sort of looked at, we were having some issues with our financing at that time, and I looked at Columbine, and I was like, I don't want to come out with a movie where the heroes end up, killing hundreds of federal agents, with literally a vast and infinite store of automatic weaponry. It just felt like the wrong, even though it wasn't saying that was, it was turning them into anti-heroes. It was not saying in any way, this is what you should do. It was showing you in a way why it's what you should not do. But that's, how movies are.
Oh, yeah. I remember Norman Jewison wanted Rollerball to be this like unpleasant indictment of sports, but everyone just like loved it and didn't see that there was any satire.
Yeah, or like Scarface, which is one of my all-time favorite De Palma movies, and I think the greatest thing Oliver Stone has ever done, is clearly a satire of capitalism in the American way, but is largely now become a kind of manual, like The Art of War for gangsters. So I basically didn't let it keep. I mean, I basically killed it. There was a possibility we could have kept going and gotten off the ground, but I felt it was there. This happened to me twice. It happened to me with a cable show we sold to AMC about the militia movement. Because I find these issues, obviously, if you look at my doc work, I've gotten into a lot of this stuff, these issues and themes in my docs. But in narrative, it's very tricky because it can be very negatively influential. And so we basically backed off of something and I went and made Fever instead, which was a much smaller film. And I was really happy with that. But that was the one that was very close. Mm. That did not happen. Yeah. And it's a great script. I really love, and a lot of people in town love the script. A lot of actors read it and wanted to be in it. But if you read it now, you're just like, oh my God, it's so inflammatory. And if you look at what came after in the country, like it kind of went the way the movie sort of went.
Yeah. I was going to say you probably never circled back to it, just in some ways, after Columbine, then 9/11 wasn't too long after. And you just kind of feel like the world changed. And it, yeah.
Well, yeah. And Timothy McVeigh and like, oh my God. Like, I mean, and now we're basically, now Jan 6, it's like, now I would never make it. Now you'd be like, I'd probably be hailed as some kind of MAGA, warrior.
Yeah.
When you were promoting Fever, I saw in a 2001 interview, you were then working on another project about the death, a thriller, you said, about the death of Broadway in the early 80s.
Yeah, there was a movie I wrote called Charlie Wonderland about a kid who, it was kind of like Oliver Twist meets All That Jazz. It was a very dark examination of a homeless kid, a child. What happened was I was on Broadway from 1977 to 1982, doing two long running Broadway shows back to back. And I was working in Times Square from like the age 13 to 17, 18, when Times Square was a complete shithole. And so the disparity between my world of like Peter Pan, say, which I was in for years, which was, this big jazzy Broadway show. And like next door to us was the Scientology Center. And that was before Scientology really got well healed. And they were basically like barefoot homeless kids living in there. And I'd go play pinball with like street hustlers who were like 12, like between 9 and 14, 15, like child street hustlers, basically. And we all hung out together because we were all kids. I'd be doing a show, matinee on Wednesday. I'd have to wait for 5 hours to do the evening show. And we all ended up kind of thrown together in this world with like the cops chasing us and crazy shit going on. And like, living in Times Square as a youth. So I saw a lot of incredibly intense stuff go down. And the disparity that now is really, I think, the American disparity of sort of the wealth, you know, sort of the who has money and who does not. And so I wrote a movie about that, about a kid who ends up living underneath a Broadway house. A doorman sort of takes him in, allows him to sleep there unbeknownst to everyone else, and sort of gets caught up in the world of Times Square 1980. But if you think about it, I loved it and I had to write it. It was just something I had to get off my chest. It was all stuff I had seen. But I mean, it was, you know, it was like a hard R-rated movie starring a 13-year-old. Like, there's no way in hell anyone was going to finance that.
Yeah, that sounds amazing, though.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it's like an A24 movie now, but I still don't think anyone would finance. It's a really gritty film about a child in that world. And it would cost a lot of money because it's all Times Square 1980. So it's really not something you could easily do cheaply.
Gritty basket case era Times Square.
That's right.
I also did not realize that you went from Lost Boy Peter Pan to Vampire Lost Boys.
Yeah, well, I was actually John Darling in Peter Pan. I wasn't, but I did, yes. I ended up in Neverland, but I wasn't one of the Lost Boys. So.
Yeah, where does... Well, I guess first question, since we couldn't find that much written about it, was the Howard Stern Rock and Roll High School remake ever a real thing?
It was. I got paid to write it. It was a lot of fun to write. I had what I think is a great take on it, but it was for a company that I think was never, it's just one of those things. They were never going to do it, but I had a good time writing it. I mean, it's, you know, there were a few things that I wrote that I really enjoyed that didn't get made. I wrote that. I wrote a movie for Showtime about the Williams sisters, actually, which was not unlike King Richard, but it was like written 20 years before.
Wait, it was actually about them, or it was about
characters? It was about them. It was about their childhood. So Richard was really the third lead, or almost really the lead. It was very much like King Richard. It was very much about that world, and it really should have been done by the people who did the film, who did King Richard, which I really liked a lot. So that movie found the right home in a way. But around the same time, I wrote Rock and Roll High School, and this is really kind of a gonzo piss take because it was about kind of a washed out sort of death metal rocker who ends up a teacher at a high school. And it's not like School of Rock. It's like, it's just a totally effed up. it was more like Rock and Roll High School. I mean, it really had the spirit of kind of that era, or Corman, or like Eating Raoul, like certain kind of indie, sort of gonzo indie movies that I had grown up with that were more like kids really going off. And it was a lot of fun to write, but it just wasn't, I knew even while I was writing, I was like, no one's ever, I don't think anyone behind this is really capable of getting a movie off the ground.
Was Stern going to be in it, or was he just producing?
No, he was a producer on it. He really had nothing to do with it. I think he had just like, I think he had bought the name and set it up somewhere, but I think it was like not at a great company. And I just didn't think they were ever going to do it. And it wasn't like, it wasn't close enough to me personally that it was the kind of thing I would take. And then I could have gotten it made on my own, but I just was busy doing other stuff and directing other stuff at the time.
Yeah. The only thing I could find was it was announced in like July 2008. And it mentions that Stern acquired the rights, I think, to that and Porky's in 2002. You know, as a listener of his show, he would always talk about those movies. And I was always like, what's going on? Why aren't they coming out? And
nothing. Nothing.
Yeah, that's a cool take. I mean, not having the Ramones, I like that. I mean, death metal fan, I like that idea.
Well, and I mean, whether that movie or a similar, just knowing your long relationship to, you know, music and real bands, the idea of you doing some kind of wild rock and roll movie, I'd still like to see it. So,
yeah,
it still time.
Fun. It would have been fun. Yeah. Yeah. But not to be.
Yeah. And then The Gate is something that I feel like that has a fair amount of information available online.
Yeah, The Gate was in pre-production. The Gate didn't happen because it was what I wanted to do was expensive, and I didn't want to do an inexpensive version of it. I wanted to do how I pitched it to Andres, who came to me. He was the Andres Amore produced the original, and he came to me. He was a fan of a couple other films I'd done. I think the Ben 10 movies I'd done at Cartoon Network, which were kind of like, I call them kid noir, especially the first one. It was really like a noir film with a little kid. And he you know, asked me if I was interested in it. And I was a huge fan of the original. And, you know, as you know, I love like in-camera effects and, you know, stop motion and all of that. And I've done
and
a lot.
And for those who haven't seen The Gage, so it came out 87, yeah, the same year as Lost Boys. And that was a very young Stephen Dorff and his friend, yeah, basically end up opening a gateway to hell in their backyard. It's kind of like a Amblin movie on crack in a way.
Yeah,
but it has some truly amazing stop motion. Like that, my favorite kind of old effects where you're like, how'd they do that? Which I feel is a question I rarely ask myself, even with amazing effects now. You're just like, a computer did it. And you stop thinking about it.
Yeah, they had foreground miniatures. They had like forced perspective gags. They had very imaginative kind of in-camera gags. And the whole thing took place in their house while their parents were gone. So it was this. And so the essence of the original that I liked a lot that I thought would be worth. I mean, you never want to make a remake if you can't do something different and not necessarily better, but just different. Like the, you know, Carpenter's remake of The Thing is one of the greatest horror movies of all time, and it doesn't take away from the original film, which is also great. The Body Snatchers also. And I think my approach was similar in that I really liked the original Gate, sort of how I felt about Rock and Roll High School. I didn't want to try to just bring it up to date, which is kind of lame. I wanted to make a different movie with those ideas. And the movie I wanted to make was a war movie. I wanted to make Saving Private Ryan with kids, right? and it just the whole first 25 minutes of Private Ryan, I wanted to make a home invasion movie with just an infinite number of minions, which were the devil's creatures that are in the original Gate. And so these kids are just like, literally by the end of the movie, it was super violent. I mean, it would have been PG-13. But it was just an assault and it never stopped and almost all happened in real time. And by the end of the movie, when the parents get home, the kids are standing on the front lawn and the parents are happy to see them, but they don't realize that the house is just a facade by then. And there's literally nothing beyond the front wall of the house. It's fucking gone. So we did an enormous amount of pre-production work with visual effects artists. I was going to do it in 3D. So I was working with stereoscopic people as well, and a ton of storyboarding because it was just 1.5 hour long, incredibly aggressive action sequence. And we got very, very close. There was like one piece of our financing at the end that didn't come through, and it kind of stalled out. And then honestly, like, I don't know, I'm kind of a stickler for this stuff. It's what I did with Weed. It got to a point where Stranger Things happened, and I thought, you know what, they kind of beat us to the punch. Like, Stranger Things is really good and it was really well done. And it kind of took what I wanted to do, which was take some of that Amblin essence. I mean, they're more retro than I would have been because I wouldn't have been retro at all. But
yours would have been set now.
Set now, about now, but with the sort of that Amblin spirit of sort of a dark world that kids inhabit that has Jeopardy that's still PG-13 that isn't like no one's heads exploding. So. And I just felt like we'd seen it. You know, I just felt like there was no way to have, you know, a group of friends in sort of Jeopardy with supernatural forces and not feel like you were just sort of making a rehash of Stranger Things. And so I stepped off at that point and just said, if you guys are going to do it elsewhere. But I didn't really want to do it anymore at that point.
Well, yeah, what was crazy was because you were starting this right before, I mean, right when 3D was taking off, you know. And so, and when Josh pointed out on your website, your storyboards, the storyboards looked amazing. Like the kid's like going down these stairs, he's got a paint gun and the minions are coming at him. They're grabbing at his helmet. And it's the type of 3D I love in horror where it's coming at you. You're throwing paintballs at the screen. Minions are getting,
yeah,
it looked incredible, that sequence. And I'm like,
it was a spectacle. Yeah. The whole movie was like that. It was all like that aggressive. They find the geode on like page 3 and it's like, it's on like by page 5. So, you know, and then of course in ours, it ends with this sort of unleashed titanic demon that sort of tears the entire rest of the house to pieces. But it was, you know, again, it had an Amblin vibe in that the kids have a backstory. There's trouble at home. It's like, you know, there's relationships between them. It was all of that. It was a ton of fun to develop, but there wasn't a way to do it to scale that in a way that I would want it to do it. I mean, I could see, I guess in today's world, it would be done for a streamer, you know, as part of some other something or other. And also, I really loved Attack the Block. I don't remember what year that came out. And that didn't influence me one way or the other in terms of wanting or not wanting to do it. But I was happy to see somebody do a film like I had in my head well, which was sort of young people, no parents around, sort of troubled kids kind of at war with these supernatural forces. That had a similar kind of tone to what I was aiming for. Ours was just, it was just bigger. It was just ridiculously big in scope.
It was 3D something. I mean, you sounded like you were excited about it, but was that something that they wanted you to do, or did you kind of bring that?
No, I brought that in. I felt sort of like you were just saying that the 3D that was happening was not utilizing 3D. It just seemed pointless and nothing was coming at the screen. It was not immersive. I mean, obviously, eventually we got Avatar and Cameron did it right, but Avatar is very stately. And I like, you know, aggressive, what people think of as B movies, and no one was doing that. And when I grew up, those were the kinds of movies that you would see in 3D. They were horror movies or they were really crazy movies and they were in 3D and they utilized the 3D. And I just thought for kids, that would be really cool to have a completely immersive experience in the service of something for a younger audience.
Yeah, I would have loved that, to have the creatures actually coming at you. And I saw in an interview, you said your biggest influence was The Haunting. So it seemed like you're coming at it from all the right directions too. So
yeah, I loved how in The Haunting, like that's something I thought would have been really good in 3D, was I loved how in The Haunting, Wise used the house in this incredible, it had so much character, just a house. It's also something that's missed in either remakes of that film or other films about haunted houses where, and he was doing that without 3D and with very limited effects, obviously, because the film was made so long ago. But it really felt visceral and immersive. And so I love that idea of like the house having a character of its own and then doing things with that in 3D.
Did you get, I mean, were you looking into casting at all? Or I suppose if it was kids, it's a little
different. It was kids. Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did casting. I had casting agent and we had some really good readings with kids who would have been great, who are now like older, some of whom became kind of big Disney stars after that, actually. But we had a really good sort of interesting group of kids that I was looking at.
I found one thing online. Oh man, it ate me up. I was like, damn, it's like H.R. Giger was attached to design some of the creatures.
Yeah, Giger was doing the new Minions. So yeah, it would have been pretty cool.
Oh my God. Damn, I can't find any drawings, unfortunately. But
I mean, for certain things, ideas like have to get done right or they just shouldn't get done at all. So I don't have any regret really, because it was becoming clear it was not going to be possible to do it the way I had in my head. And I didn't really, sort of a lesser version would have been a bummer. And I don't think it would have worked. So.
Got anything else, Steve?
I know we're running out of time. I just saw, there was just a couple other things I stumbled upon. You were going to write for MTV, a Napster movie. And I know you ended up turning it into a documentary, but how was that process of trying to turn that into like a feature?
Yeah, I mean, that was a movie I wrote. I sold it to Paramount. I wrote it there. I wrote many drafts there. And then it went into turnaround because I wrote it for MTV Films and everyone there got let go and MTV Films eventually died. But I wanted to make the movie because I had gotten to meet all of the Sean Fanning and Sean Parker and all the record label people. And it was a very important story to me. I'm actually working on a sort of revived version of that story right now, both in narrative and doc. It's just an incredibly epic tale and it has so much to do with the world we live in. So I just didn't let it go. I just thought, you know, it may actually work better in doc form than my indie like movie biopic version was. So I'm very satisfied with the film that we eventually made. It kind of was the whole vision for the movie got realized in doc form. So that was fine. But I think there's more story to tell, just given where we've ended up culturally with streaming and everything else. So,
Well, I feel like that's the kind of story where it was so big when you lived through it. But I think for younger people who are either babies or not even born when Napster was happening, it's kind of, they don't really know about it.
Exactly. Yeah. They don't know that that's what started, you know, no Napster, no iPhone, basically no Apple, really not the Apple we know of today. So, I mean, it's certainly no Netflix. So yeah, it was kind of the genesis of everything.
Right on. And one last one. I'm sorry, we'll let you go.
That's all right. I'm good.
I read about you were going to make an Alan Rickman movie called Acts of Charity. I stumbled upon it.
Yeah, there was another film I actually was pretty far along on. It was a very dark satire about foreign aid workers. And so it was basically a war movie, a hot zone war movie. I mean, Alan Rickman was the co-lead. I wrote it with, it was actually written by a writer named Ships Hardy, who was a friend of mine in the advertising world, who was, funnily enough, Tom Hardy's dad.
Oh,
And
wow.
we worked in, I had a production company in London. We were doing commercials together. Was a creative director in that agency. It's an amazing script, but a comedy about famine relief is a hard sell, believe it or not. So it was just one of those that we got close, started to get close on, and then realized it was just not going to get funded.
But Rickman was attached to it.
Rickman was attached. He was a friend of mine. It's a great part. Sort of this jaded, sort of hot zone journalist who travels from like hot, devastation to devastation. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Like Salvador in a way.
Yeah, but funny.
Yeah, but
So,
funny.
yeah. You know what it was like? What came later was Three Kings. It was very much like that.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Which I know was criticized for making light of war, even though
Exactly. Yes. Even though it's a good
satire
movie.
people, come on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, and then
Yeah.
one very last one. You were probably joking about this because this was in Film Threat and that interview was so crazy. But was there a second after Bill and Ted Bogus Journey that they wanted just to have you and George Carlin because Keanu Reeves' contract ran out for a Bill and Ted 3?
No,
Okay.
that is
That's
absolutely
probably
not true.
because yeah, all right, that's cool. Yeah, because the
Yeah,
line after
there's.
that was about them going inside your body, and I was like, that's probably
Yeah,
just okay. I've read a lot of
no.
interviews with you, and sometimes I was like, is this a real idea or is this
Yeah,
him just
no. I mean, the problem when you're a child actor and you start getting interviewed when you're like 10 years old is by the time you're 25, you really don't have any patience for them anymore. And you say
Yeah.
really dumb shit. So.
No, it was all good. It was funny. That was about it. Yeah, 'cause I caught like an interview with you like on the Joan Rivers show, and she literally called up her daughter halfway through the
She did,
interview.
yeah. She tried to hook me up with
Sketch.
her daughter on live television. It was extremely uncomfortable
So that was real
for both of
then.
us. That was real,
Oh my God. All right, yeah, that's on
yeah.
YouTube. I was
That's
checking
good
so
TV right there.
yeah, but it
Yeah.
was on it does it's like yeah, it was kind of uncomfortable to watch. All right.
Yeah.
That's cool. All
All
right.
right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for
Yeah,
joining
man.
us,
Yeah.
Alex Winter. Everyone should check out Destroy All Neighbors. The time we're recording this, it's available on Shudder, but if you're listening to this months from now, it's probably available everywhere.
Yeah, it will be then.
Are you anywhere on social media you wish for people to find you?
I mean, I'm on Instagram primarily, and or Facebook. You can find me there on either of those pretty easily.
All
So,
right. Well,
yeah.
we are on all the ever-changing socials landscape. Also recommend people check out our Patreon if they would like some extra content. But until next time, this is Josh Miller and
Steven Scarlatta.
saying we won't see you at the movies.